What happens when hunger sharpens your senses and poverty becomes your teacher? In 1920s Paris, a young writer named Ernest Hemingway discovered that deprivation could be a gift, that empty pockets and an empty stomach could somehow fill the page with truth. His memoir of those years captures something we've almost forgotten, that art demands sacrifice, that beauty emerges from struggle, and that the richest experiences often come when we have the least. Before celebrity corrupted him, before wealth made him careless, Hemingway learned to write with nothing but discipline, a sharp pencil, and the city of Paris as his classroom. What he discovered there would change American literature forever. Every creative person wrestles with the blank page. Hemingway defeated it through ritual, rising before dawn, walking to the Closerie des Lilas, where waiters protected his solitude. His method was deceptively simple. Write one true sentence. Not clever or beautiful, just true. All you have to do is write one true sentence. Write the truest sentence that you know. This could be describing the scene at dawn or how a waiter folded his napkin, but it had to be absolutely honest. Hemingway simply showed up, same time, same place, with blue moleskin notebooks and two sharpened pencils. He'd write until reaching a natural stopping point, crucially always ending when he knew what came next. This created momentum, a bridge to tomorrow's work. Between sessions, he deliberately avoided thinking about his writing, letting his subconscious solve problems while he watched boxing or studied paintings. His genius wasn't talent alone, but understanding that creativity requires both intense focus and strategic rest. Shakespeare and Company wasn't just a shop, it was oxygen for drowning artists. Sylvia Beach's bookstore at 12 Rue de l'Odéon became Hemingway's lifeline when money was scarce, but hunger for books remained desperate. The warm space offered floor-to-ceiling shelves, while photographs of Joyce, Pound, and other modernists covered the walls, looking really alive, even if they were only photographs. When Hemingway confessed he couldn't afford the 12-franc lending library deposit, Sylvia immediately made him a card and told him to pay whenever convenient. "No one that I ever knew was nicer to me," he writes. Through Shakespeare and Company, he methodically educated himself, working through Turgenev, D.H. Lawrence, and Dostoevsky. When he told Hadley about this miraculous place, they paid the deposit despite their poverty, then celebrated with a perfect Paris afternoon, walking Rue de Seine to look at paintings, stopping for coffee, returning home for a simple meal with wine from the cooperative. Paris wasn't just Hemingway's home. It was his teacher, his muse, his laboratory. From their sixth-floor walk-up on Rue Cardinal-Lemoyne, he preferred turning left along the sun-dappled quays with views of Île Saint-Louis and Notre-Dame's Gothic spires. The riverside bookstalls offered unexpected treasures, including cheap American books abandoned by wealthy tourists. Hemingway walked these quays when wrestling with creative problems, finding it easier to think while observing people absorbed in their crafts, boat workers, booksellers, artists. At Île de la Cité's bow-shaped tip, serious fishermen worked the Seine's complex currents. These weren't romantic Parisians fishing for leisure. They were pensioners and laborers bringing home real catches. With the fishermen and the life on the river, the beautiful barges with their own life, the tugs with their smokestacks that folded back to get under the bridges, I could never be lonely along the river. The Seine's flowing waters became a metaphor for the creative current he sought to tap. Spring brought what he called limitless happiness, though false springs and bitter rains mirrored his creative cycles, periods of flourishing followed by necessary retreats. "You got very hungry when you did not eat enough in Paris," Hemingway writes with characteristic understatement. His poverty wasn't romanticized, but presented as raw reality, a constant companion that both tormented and taught. Hunger proved particularly challenging amid Paris's celebrated food culture, bakery windows displaying fresh croissants, aromatic cafes, street vendors selling roasted chestnuts. Hemingway developed specific walking routes to avoid food shops, carefully navigating until he reached Shakespeare and Company, where Sylvia Beach would notice his increasing gauntness but tactfully avoid mentioning it. Yet hunger heightened his perception of art. After visiting the Luxembourg Museum on an empty stomach, colors became more vibrant, emotions more intense. Hunger is good discipline, he concludes. When 600 francs arrived from Der Querschnitt, his celebration meal at Lips reflected both modesty and dignity: beer, potato salad, and sausage. This financial precariousness created constant tension between artistic integrity and commercial necessity. Hemingway passionately argued against writing for commercial appeal. "I did not believe anyone could write any way except the very best he could write without destroying his talent." This conviction, maintained even during his hungriest days, reflected unwavering commitment to artistic authenticity. Paris gave Hemingway an extraordinary education through relationships with established writers, sometimes nurturing, sometimes competitive, always instructive. Gertrude Stein, surrounded by Cezanne, Matisse, and Picasso paintings, offered criticism and encouragement. She called Up in Michigan unpublishable, despite being good, advised choosing between buying clothes or pictures. Yet Hemingway observed her need for publication to sustain happiness. Their friendship ended after he overheard an intimate exchange revealing vulnerability at odds with her public persona. Ezra Pound represented different mentorship, the most generous writer I have ever known, and the most disinterested, always doing something practical for artists he believed in. Ford Madox Ford provided lessons in what to avoid, but Scott Fitzgerald embodied the most complicated friendship. Hemingway was struck by his talent, as natural as the pattern on a butterfly's wings. Yet Fitzgerald's behavior often tested this respect. Zelda's jealousy of Scott's work pulled him from writing into drunken parties. Hemingway maintained loyalty when Fitzgerald was sober, recognizing genuine talent despite human frailty. The memoir darkens as Hemingway reflects on his marriage's collapse. Their first year was innocent, but the third became a nightmare and a murder year disguised as the greatest fun, the year the rich arrived. He introduces the pilot fish who precedes them, sometimes deaf, sometimes blind, but always affable. Once the rich arrive, nothing remains as it was. The most poignant passages address his guilt over leaving Hadley. Two people in love create a beacon that attracts others, but we were inexperienced in handling this attention. He confesses to loving two women simultaneously, lying to everyone, breaking all promises. Though he doesn't name Pauline Pfeiffer directly, she was the young woman who became my wife's friend, then set out to marry me. Remorse became his constant companion for 3 years, lifting only when Hadley married a better man. The book ends reflecting on those early days when we were very poor and very happy. Paris changed as they changed, but it was always Paris. The memoir's truth: art endures when everything else fails. The feast moves with you because you've earned every bite through hunger, discipline, and unwavering commitment to one true sentence at a time.